John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drop?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, January 25th, 2012. Palestinian and Israeli negotiators to meet in Amman today. Meanwhile, Israeli military forces demolish 6 houses near Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the Warid Beik area that belongs to the Anata town, northeast of the occupied East Jerusalem, and demolished 6 sheds, home to 6 families, including 5 brothers and their families. According to the Jerusalem Center for Social and Economic Rights, the houses belong to 5 brothers of Al-Jahalin family and their sister. The demolished houses are home to 36 members of the family. The center also said that the families have been subject to constant harassment and threats not only by Israeli soldiers and policemen, but also by armed Jewish settlers who want to install and expand their illegal colonies and their illegal outposts on the families' lands. Al-Jahalin is one of dozens of Palestinian villages that are unrecognized by Israel, an issue that enables the Israeli army and its military occupation enforced laws to harass the residents repeatedly, displace them, and demolish their sheds and structures. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights issued a statement on Wednesday condemning the detention of 2 Palestinians from the sit-in tent at the International Committee of the Red Cross in Jerusalem. The statement said that the detention of Palestinian Parliament member Mahmoud Totah and former Palestinian minister Khaled Abu Arafah is a retaliatory act and a form of collective punishment prohibited under Article 33 of the Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in time of war of 1949. According to the center, a large force of Israeli security officers stormed the tent set up in the yard of the Red Cross office in Sheikh Jarrah and abducted the 2 men Monday afternoon. Abu Arafah, Totah, and Ahmed Attoun, in addition to some other members of the Palestinian parliament, have been protesting since June 2010 to defy Israel's decision to violate the rights of Palestinian members of parliament who are residents of Jerusalem. On 6th of September 2011, an Israeli undercover unit kidnapped Member of Parliament Attoon from the same sit-in tent in Jerusalem and kept him in custody until he was deported to Ramallah on December 6, 2011. On Tuesday evening, Israeli troops abducted Sheikh Mohammed Frihat, 46 years old. Sheikh Frihat is a religious figure and a political leader of the Hamas movement in Al-Yamun town west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Local sources reported that dozens of Israeli soldiers broke into the home of Frihat, forced him and his family out of their home despite of the cold weather, before ransacking their house and messing with their property, causing extensive damage. Frihat was seen cuffed and blindfolded and was taken to an undisclosed location. In political news, senior Palestinian negotiator Dr. Saeb Arikat and Israeli negotiator Yitzhak Molcho will be holding a meeting in the Jordanian capital of Amman on Wednesday to discuss the resumption of Palestinian-Israeli peace talks and resolving the outstanding issues. The meeting is brokered by Jordan and the European Union. The Palestinian Authority said this meeting in Amman will be the last in the series of what has been called exploration meetings with Israeli officials. On Saturday meeting, a clash erupted between Arikat and Molcho after Arikat refused to discuss security arrangements in the meeting. Arikat said this meeting is not to discuss security issues, but to talk about the principle of the two-state solution. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, January 25th Daily Roundup News from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Ishmael.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. The British military is claiming one of their soldiers committed suicide yesterday. Afghanistan last Thursday. Six U.S. Marines were killed in a helicopter crash. Afghanistan last Friday, an Afghan National Army soldier opened fire on French NATO troops, killing four and wounding 15. On Monday, he said this was vengeance for the U.S. Marines, also part of the occupation, who pissed on the bodies of the dead. He also mentioned a second video in which British soldiers were shown abusing Afghan children. French troops are part of the same NATO occupation as the U.S. and Britain. The Taliban says this was not their work, just the work of someone who has had enough of foreign occupation of the country. France threatened to pull out of the war as a result of this attack, but now Sarkozy claims French troops will stay until the end of the year. Iraq, ongoing. Human Rights Watch has uncovered another secret prison where detainees are beaten and given electric shocks. Human Rights Watch has also condemned Maliki's Shiite-dominated regime for crackdowns on peaceful protesters and oppression of women and girls. When protest is outlawed, other things happen. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. Four car bombs exploded in Shiite areas of the city, killing at least 14 people and wounding at least 75. The first bomb exploded in an area where day laborers were waiting for work. This kind of thing did not happen prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Iraq, yesterday, six more bombs exploded in places other than Baghdad. Mr. Barack Obama, 8 years of U.S. occupation left Iraq in chaos, one of the most violent places on earth. Brutal sectarian attacks happened while U.S. troops were there, and they happen now after U.S. troops have left. What Bush did in Iraq is no model for Afghanistan. Bring all the troops home today. In 2007, former CIA operative John Krakauer appeared on CBS News to defend waterboarding captured fighters in Afghanistan. He claimed waterboarding produced information about upcoming Al-Qaeda attacks. Did it ever occur to John that these upcoming operations might have been what people were told to tell him under torture? To jerk Uncle Sam's chain? Now the Department of Injustice is prosecuting John Caracal, not for defending torture, but for confirming that the CIA was waterboarding people. They're upset that information he provided to reporters in turn reached defense attorneys for captured fighters. Perhaps the reason for the prosecution is a CBS video containing this soundtrack.
The director of the CIA testifies behind closed doors on Capitol Hill today.
That was back in 2007.
About the controversial destruction of videotapes that recorded the interrogations of two terror suspects. John Kiriakou is a former CIA officer who led the raid which captured the Al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah. And he joins us this morning in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about this a little bit, because we have done segments on waterboarding before on this show, shown what it's about. Many even former CIA officials say that this is in fact torture. This technique was used on Zubaydah to what result?
The result was that he opened up and cooperated fully.
Right. He literally cracked like an egg.
It was quite dramatic.
How long in the process of the waterboarding did it take before he divulged his information?
He lasted about 30 or 35 seconds.
35
and then he
seconds.
He said he couldn't take it anymore. And the next morning he said that Allah had come to him in his cell and told him to cooperate because it would make it easier on the other brothers who had been captured.
Right. And how long had he been in the interrogation process before the waterboarding took place?
Well, he wasn't interrogated for about 4 weeks at first because he was so severely wounded in the capture. But then it was about, 4 or 5 weeks before he was finally waterboarded.
Right. So he's waterboarded. He cracks like an egg. The next morning he gets up. He says he has a vision. What kind of information did he impart then?
He gave us detailed information on planned Al-Qaeda attacks. Once that information became a little bit dated, he began providing information on Al-Qaeda's leaders and different kinds of operations that they might be conceptualizing.
Right, right. This controversy and discussion continues in this country about waterboarding. Do you consider waterboarding torture?
I do consider it torture. And this is something that I've struggled with for several years, because even though I do believe it's torture, I think that it was necessary at the time. Because the information was so important, and we were so worried about another major terrorist attack on U.S. soil, we had no other way of getting the information in a short period of time.
Right. All right. Thank you very, very much, John.
Thanks for having me.
I do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for all those bag search checkpoints and false security alerts. All those upcoming attacks were probably fakes designed to be released under torture and create phony security alerts all over the U.S. Next time you can't get on public transportation because there was a bag search checkpoint, blame people like John Caracal for torturing people and then accepting information produced by torture at face value. What Mr. Caracal is being charged with violating the Espionage Act for is probably talking about waterboarding in such a way as to allow defense attorneys to get statements made under torture excluded even from military tribunals. Since they can't prosecute people using statements obtained under torture, they're instead prosecuting the man they say made it possible to prove the defendant's statements were made under torture. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. The 20th of January was the second anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's notorious Citizens United case, which legalized unlimited corporate campaign cash in U.S. politics. Move to amend, supported by Occupy protesters from all over the U.S., vowed to occupy the courts on that day, and at the U.S. Supreme Court they succeeded in doing exactly that. Even an Occupy tent went up on the steps of the Supreme Court as protesters stormed the steps and plaza for the second time in 3 days. The demand was for a constitutional amendment to declare that corporations are not people and are not protected by constitutional rights. Corporations are property, not people. The first stage of the direct action was the removal of the fence the police had put up to protect the Supreme Court steps from the First Amendment.
Who says our steps?
Who says
our steps?
Who says
our steps?
Who says
our steps?
Check this out. This railing goes together with little pins, which are not secured on the far side. You pull these pins, the whole fence comes apart.
Our steps. Our steps.
Almost got it. Like I said, them pins come out, it comes apart. Pins top, pins bottom. Pull the pin, it comes apart.
Our steps.
Where's the bottom pin? Get the bottom. Get the bottom.
Our steps.
Our steps.
Our steps.
Gotta line it up. Line it up.
Our steps.
Our steps.
Our steps.
It's gotta be straight. It's twisted.
Our steps.
Our steps.
Enemy approaching.
Our steps. Our steps.
Our steps.
Hey, hey,
hey. Watch your hands,
buddy.
Watch your hands.
That's assault.
Give me a badge number. And it parts! Go, go! It parts! It's down!
Our guard! Our guard!
Crowd surges forward! Barriers are down! Cops standing past the steps, that's all they really care about. The second stage of the direct action was pushing the cops up the lower Supreme Court stairs one step at a time. Protesters stood with their backs to the cops and backed up at intervals until the police had been pushed all the way to the plaza. Now they got the first five steps. There's only three more to go to the plaza. Then came the third stage of the direct action. Protesters on top of the lower stairs suddenly charged into court, breaking through the police lines, which had been changed from the original defensive position when the fence collapsed. Instead of a zone defense, the cops tried a blitz with all of their officers on the front line. As soon as the first protesters broke through, they had a guaranteed touchdown all the way to the top of the Supreme Court steps and the ceremonial doors as the police were burned on the blitz. They got the plaza! They got the plaza! They push, they push, they push! We got one going up the inner steps! Yeah! They mount the inner steps! Charging the building itself! They got it! Cops are burned on the blitz! Burned on the blitz, baby! Burned on the blitz! The police were about as happy about this as Occupy is about Citizens United and all that campaign cash. Undercover cops emerged from the crowd, deliberately starting fights. One of them tackled a protester, only to find other protesters trying to tackle him as he almost tumbled down the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. Looks like two arrests so far. Whoa, whoa, whoa! Big fight. Swirling fight!
Fight! Fight! Fight! Fight!
Who's been on this? What the heck is this? An undercover? What is going on here? What is going on? Is there an undercover?
Fucking fashion!
That's him right there, yeah, the plane was.
Oh, that's a cop.
Pull him out.
Plant, right here, plant!
Pull him out! Pull him out! Pull him out!
The whole world is watching!
Pull him out!
So there was a plainclothes officer in here that started pushing people around. I'm trying to get his face on here again, but...
Mike,
Jay!
had a gray hoodie on.
Yeah.
And a gun.
Andy had a gun under his belt. Cops are here to instigate violence.
He was here to instigate violence. He started.
Okay. Jerk, it was your plant that made that happen. It was your plant in the gray hoodie that made that shit happen, man. We're fucking peaceful. Fucking pigs.
There's a lot of stuff going on
this
here, guys.
This is not America!
At least four arrests so far.
Did you see the plant? Did you see the plant that they had, the plainclothes officer that was out here that started all the pushing? It was the plainclothes officer that started the pushing. Sent out plainclothes officers to push peaceful protesters down the stairs and instigate violence to make us look like the assholes.
At least the asshole wearing a police gun under all that protester clothing in the process of pushing people down the stairs and tackling someone almost went headfirst down that stone staircase himself. The situation stabilized as the undercover pigs were identified and the rest of the cops switched to their backup plan of making individual arrests from the top of the crowd, arresting possibly 11 people as they pushed everybody back down the stairs to the plaza. By the end of the day, at least 3 and possibly as many as 5 undercover cops have been identified, meaning they are now useless against Occupy DC and cannot show their faces again among protesters in DC. Such is the price of declaring that corporations have freedom of speech and can spend unlimited campaign cash on buying American elections. You get the Supreme Court occupied twice in 3 days.
On the 24th of January, activists dressed up as referees gathered in front of the U.S. Capitol to protest foul play by supporters of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline.
With the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline already blocked twice by President Obama, word is the congressional Republicans are now going to try to attach Keystone XL language to the highway bill, and the American Petroleum Institute is going to be showering unlimited campaign cash all over Capitol Hill, taking advantage of Citizens United. This is foul play. The protesters, both in front of the Capitol and in front of the American Petroleum Institute, threw referees, flags, and blue whistles symbolic of API's cheating and congressional corruption.
Celebration for the fact that all your work over the last few months really paid off. There are people here who got arrested in August, I know. And there are people here who circled the White House in November, I know. And there are people all over the country today doing this same thing, putting on the same shirts, the same way. What we're about here today, in part, is going on offense. We've been playing defense for a long time, trying to stop bad things, and at least for the moment, we've slowed down one very bad thing, that Keystone Pipeline. And that's good news. And we owe a debt of thanks to the president, not only because he did the right thing, but because he did the right thing knowing that it was going to hurt. A week before the president made his decision to deny the permit, the head of the American Petroleum Institute said, in public, if you do that, there will be huge political consequences. And these guys have the money to make good that threat. So, it wasn't just the right thing, it was a brave thing. But it's that money that we've got to start talking about. Because that money is warping our political process in the worst possible ways. When the House of Representatives took a vote about Keystone, they voted 234 to 193 to speed up that Keystone approval process. And our friend Steve Kretzmann at All Change International is here someplace. He and his team, within a few minutes, had crunched the numbers and were able to tell us that those 234 congressmen had taken $42 million from the fossil fuel industry. That's not right. It's just not right. We've gotten used to the idea that this is how things work in Washington, but it is not right that that is how they work, and we've got to start talking about that. 2 weeks from now, there's going to be the Super Bowl, okay? Now, I'm rooting for the Patriots, because I'm from New England. But I would be outraged if it turned out someone broke the story the day of the Super Bowl that the owner of the Patriots had been paying off the referees. I'd be outraged. It would be a national scandal. Every newspaper in America would be all over it. People would be up in arms. That exact same thing happens in Congress should be 10 times the scandal. That's why we're here, to blow the whistle on that kind of collusion. And the best example of it, and the thing we really want to start talking about today, is the fact that this year, as most years, Congress will vote to give subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer money. Not because they need a subsidy. We've known how to burn coal and gas and oil for 250 years. There's no secret to it that we need to subsidize for them to figure out. And it's not because they need the money. They're the most profitable industry on earth. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. What's going on instead is that they are giving small presents to our legislators, and in return, our legislators are giving them big presents with our money. For every dollar that they spend in campaign donations, the fossil fuel industry, they get $320 in subsidies. It's wrong and stupid and not going to happen unchallenged anymore.
And don't be quiet. You know, as we stand here on this side of the Capitol building, I know all over the world, people live under a myth where they see this as the symbol of democracy. We know that this is really the symbol of the United Corporate States of America. That whatever corporations peddle, it seems that our legislators are buying. They buy everything from what the banks have to say to everything what the oil companies had to say. We even went to war over oil. Let's not forget.
At the conclusion of the Capitol Hill rally, protesters marched to the Capitol South Metro, got off at the McPherson Square exit, and marched to the headquarters of the American Petroleum Institute, where the whistles were blown and the flags were thrown, symbolic of the fouls of the American Petroleum Institute corrupting American democracy with campaign cash.
Here they come on final approach, the American Petroleum Institute. Foul, big oil corrupting Congress. First flag is thrown. Here come the few coming up on them. Flag is thrown. Their security don't look too happy.
That's the sound of protesters against the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline outside the American Petroleum Institute, blowing the whistle on their filthy campaign cash corrupting American politics and on corrupt GOP congressmen who, in return for that campaign cash, are now going to try to attach the Keystone XL pipeline to the highway funding bill.
In December, an article appeared in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that exposes the impact of surface and mountaintop removal coal mining on water quality downstream of mining sites. The study reveals that the problem persists many years after reclamation, indicating current environmental protection strategies are not addressing the problem. The findings show a clear connection between the amount of mining in a watershed area and the impact on water quality downstream. The study, titled Cumulative Impacts of Mountaintop Mining on an Appalachian Watershed, conducted by Duke University at the Hobet Mine Complex in southern West Virginia, was the first to measure water quality both upstream and downstream of mining discharge outlets. One crucial measurement was more than 8 times higher than the standard set by the Environmental Protection Agency. The findings confirm what opponents of mountaintop removal mining have been saying for years, that these destructive mining methods are responsible for contaminating surface waters in many communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Emily Bernhardt, an associate professor of biology at Duke University and co-author of the study. She explains how the research was conducted, what it reveals, and the next steps to better understanding the impacts of surface mining on water quality.
What is really important about this recently published study is that we show in a large watershed with a tremendous amount of surface mining, we show a very clear relationship between the absolute amount of mining and the level of water quality impact downstream. So we took samples upstream of the Hobet Mine Complex and then through the Mud River as it flowed through the Hobet Mine Complex, basically with 8 new tributaries contributing additional mining runoff into the stream, and we see this very consistent, very strong relationship between the amount of mining being drained and a large number of trace elements and metals and salts in the Mud River itself.
Is it killing aquatic life or causing deformities? Can you say more about that?
The two components to my answer to that question. The first is about fish. So selenium, which is an important contaminant in alkaline mine drainage, is highly elevated in the Mud River system, and it has been clearly associated with a very high incidence of fish deformities in the Mud River Reservoir, which is about 10 kilometers downstream of the last mining-impacted tributary of the Mud River. And so there's clearly an effect on fish communities in this system. We did not measure the effects on insects in the Mud River itself, but in other work we're doing, looking regionally at stream insect communities, and stream insects make up the base of the food web in all of these systems. In regional analysis done by our group here at Duke, but also by the US EPA, we see a strong decline in the number of sensitive species of aquatic insects in streams once conductivity goes above 300 microsiemens. What does that mean? It just means that these very sensitive freshwater organisms cannot handle very much salinity at all, and they disappear from the system.
Emily Bernhardt, has this kind of study ever been done before, where you go upstream and downstream of mining discharge outlets and measure the differences, or is this a first?
It's a little bit remarkable that this is actually a first, because what I think is so powerful about this study is it's very simple. Just going to a large mine complex where a river happens to be moving through the mine complex and looking at how its chemistry changes as you move downstream.
Critics might point out that you haven't shown there's any adverse impact on humans, so what's the big deal?
There's two different reasons that we should care. One is that we often use stream insect diversity or composition as an indicator of water quality, and we use them as sort of the canaries in the coal mine. When we lose these sensitive mayflies and stoneflies and caddisflies that are really a dominant part of the communities of these Appalachian streams, we think, oh, we should be worried. There's something in that water that's not right, that's not the way that it used to be. And that may or may not lead to important human health consequences. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that we have laws to protect species living in aquatic ecosystems in this country, and we are supposed to be protecting species that are sensitive within aquatic ecosystems. And so even from just a pure legal sense, we have a responsibility to make sure that we're not losing sensitive species.
I thought it was interesting where your study says that individual permitting decisions are made without consideration of the extent of historic mining impacts. Because there's other environmental problems where if you take each permit application individually, it may seem fine, but when you add them all together, it's disastrous.
The thing with surface coal mining in this region is that each mine is directly putting waste rock and coal fragments into stream valleys. So they're putting waste directly into the river system. And every time you do that, you're contributing new pollutants. And every single mine is then adding to the background pollution load that's come from every mine in the past within that watershed. And so if we continue to permit new mines without considering all of the mines that have already occurred within a river system, then we're going to keep increasing the contaminant load and increasing the distance downstream that water quality impact can be seen. And we really do need to change the way we're thinking about this and consider the cumulative impacts. And I think the Mud River is a great example of that.
What's next for your team or for other scientists maybe working in this field?
I mean, I think the biggest open question is how do we remediate these impacts? even if coal mining were to stop tomorrow, and it's not going to do that, but even if we were, we still have impacts that are occurring even decades after mining ceases on an old surface mine. And so how can we actually go back and remediate those mines in a way that we protect the downstream water quality? And I think that's really where we need to see a lot of research dollars invested.
That was Duke University biology professor Emily Bernhardt. For more information on the issue of coal mining and the effects on water quality, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Community activists in D.C. are holding weekly protests against Wells Fargo Bank's investments in private prisons at both the 624 T Street location in Shaw and the Tivoli Theater location in Columbia Heights. On the 24th of January, the protest at Columbia Heights was reinforced by supporters from Occupy D.C.
They're taking your money to make money off of locking people up. You got to take your money out. Fargo Town, check. Wells Fargo Town, take your money out of that place right now. Close your account today.
I don't know what people think is so romantic about Wells Fargo, about settlers swarming over Indian land, about people being lynched, about people's homes being taken so they could build a goddamn railroad. I don't see what's so romantic about that.
And prisons in this country.
That's right.
In this country, people get rich off of locking people up.
Boo!
Last year, over 400,000 immigrants were detained and deported by the Obama administration. That's a record. They do that because every body in a cell is $100. $100 a day. So when you're making that kind of money, under the logic of ruthless American capitalism, what you get is, oh, that becomes logical. Putting 100 people in prison because people are getting rich off it. One of the main benefactors of this prison industry is right down the street, Wells Fargo Bank.
That's right.
And they became famous for getting a $47 billion bailout of taxpayer money.
Taxpayer money.
These were the same crooks that kicked people, poor people, out of their homes. And now they got a bailout, and they've invested that bailout money into private prison industries. So you have a situation where some people that got thrown out on the street because they got kicked out of their homes by a bank like Wells Fargo is now sitting in a jail cell that's also funded by the same bank.
Taking you where you don't want to be.
These people aren't going to stop. That's the lesson. Because when you got this much money, they're not going to stop. We're going to have to unite and stop them. Dismantle this prison industrial complex.
Right.
Dismantle this toxic link between profits and imprisonment. This is modern slavery. You got people working inside 12 hours a day, making cents, making 60 cents, making a dollar. You know, we got to start calling it modern slavery. That's not hyperbole.
That's right.
What else would you call it? So we got to stop them because they got plans looking ahead 10 years, 20 years. They got projections. They got plans. They want more people in prison. 7 million, 10 million. In 1970, you had 250,000 people in prison. Today, you have 2.5 million. It's not going to stop.
That's right.
It's not going to stop unless we stop them.
And Wells Fargo is a bank that has invested $100 million plus in privatized prisons.
Shut it down.
When we look at GEO, GEO is the second largest corporation involved in privatized prisons in the world.
In the world.
We're not talking about the United States. We're talking about
the world.
Number one is CCA, Corporation of Correctional Corporation of America. And so we must continue our rallying call. We must continue to be visible against Wells Fargo. Shut Wells Fargo down. Shut Wells Fargo down. Shut Wells Can we look at Rivers Correctional Institution in Winton, North Carolina? 90% of the prisoners there are D.C. prisoners. It is ran by GEO. When we look at the D.C. Revitalization Act that says 50% of the prisoners housed in prisons around the country or out of D.C. must be housed in privatized prisons. That means today, if there is 12,000 prisoners out of Washington, D.C., 6,000 of them are housed in privatized prisons. Each day in privatized prisons, the corporations are receiving anywhere from $60 to $70 for each one of those individuals. I was housed in Rivers Correctional Institution. I can tell you, it's a horror story. The medical treatment is horrible. The food is horrible. There are no programs there for men who are housed there, which means that when a guy come out of Rivers, he is not prepared to come back to his community to make a positive contribution. You see this fire? You see this fire? This is the fire we got to take back into our community. When they boycotted the buses in Birmingham, what did they do? They did not ride the bus. Don't go in Wells Fargo.
Don't go in there.
Go in there to take your money out. To let the door hit you in the backside. And don't ever come back.
Shut Wells Fargo down. Shut Wells Fargo down.
As candidates for the Republican Party nomination for president battle each other in primary states this year, the nation is reminded of the party's longtime history of appealing to racial hatred. Since President Johnson signed civil rights legislation 40 years ago, many politicians within the GOP have embraced racial politics to win over white voters, especially in the South, where the majority of whites had been loyal Democrats since the New Deal era of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. President Richard Nixon's exploitation of racial division to win votes in southern states is referred to as the GOP's Southern Strategy. With this November's presidential election, where Barack Obama, America's first black president, will be campaigning for re-election, issues of race are never too far below the surface. On the primary campaign trail, Newt Gingrich charged that Obama is America's greatest food stamp president in history, and also urged that 9-year-old inner-city youth be hired as janitors to clean toilets, instilling the work ethic they lack. Rick Santorum attempted to cover up a highly charged statement where he declared, "I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money." Candidate Ron Paul's history of racist rhetoric can be read in his newsletters, in which one article made this observation about the 1992 Los Angeles riots. He said order was only restored in L.A. when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks. The Republican Party's greatest contemporary hero, Ronald Reagan, very consciously launched his 1980 national campaign for the presidency in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the town where civil rights workers Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were murdered in 1964 by members of the Ku Klux Klan and the local sheriff's office. At the campaign stop in 1980, Reagan advocated the restoration of states' rights, interpreted by many in the South as advocating a return to pre-civil rights laws that banned segregation. Your reporter spoke with writer, activist, and South Carolina native Kevin Alexander Gray, who examines the long history of the Republican Party's appeal to race hatred in U.S. election campaigns and the just-concluded GOP primary election in South Carolina.
This isn't new for South Carolina. A lot of it is how, you know, the history of South Carolina and the Confederacy, being the state to fire the first shot in the Civil War, Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats, separating from the Democratic Party to become the modern Republican Party that we know it, the Southern Strategy that using race that was first coined, that phrase was first coined during the Nixon administration, and the architect of that was a fellow by the name of Harry Dent, who was the head of the RNC at the time, and then, of course, his protege was Lee Atwater, who went to work with George Bush. Lee also worked with Strom Thurmond. Lee Atwater was the head of the RNC. And then, of course, you know, you remember Willie Horton, but Willie Horton, which was raised, the issue of Willie Horton and who he was raised by Al Gore, but Willie Horton's from South Carolina. And then you come forward to, you know, Karl Rove, who is now the present-day architect of that kind of divide-and-conquer Southern strategy politics. So it is not new. And, you know, you look at Gingrich and you talk about Gingrich talking about food stamps and the food stamp president and Santorum talking about black people taking something out of white folks' pockets. But it's not like all the racism in America is confined within the borders of South Carolina. The folk ought not get that impression, because the country is profoundly racist. It is still a profoundly racist country. It's just that the racism in South Carolina, because of South Carolina's history, is so obvious.
In 2011, we had the issue of economic inequality rise to the top of the heap in many ways by the activism of the Occupy Wall Street groups across the country.
Right.
And of course, in this Republican primary season, we see a lot of appeals to racial bigotry. In terms of race and class in this 2012 election, you see them both sort of major issues with America's first black president trying to win re-election? Or you think these issues of racial bigotry are going to be subsumed, eclipsed by the issues of class when we have so much wealth going to the top and so little to the middle and the lower classes?
Well, I mean, politics is about addition and subtraction. You figure race and ethnicity is indifference, being different from the white male patriarchal mindset. That's the Republican stock and trade. You know, when they're talking about taking back America, they're talking about taking it back from everybody else that doesn't follow that mindset or that model. So that remains important. Of course, when you're talking about white and playing race, you're saying to whites who are maybe economically impoverished or struggling or whatever, working class, that, hey, you got something beyond them. You got your whiteness. And that's always going to be what folk play. Obviously, the issue is about class. And some of the issues everybody's getting right. It's just that they're misdefining them. You know, when you talk about crony capitalism, well, that's the definition of how Newt Gingrich came up through the system. That's about using government to benefit yourself or your friends. In many respects, it's about to the victor belongs the spoils. So we got to figure out, is that what we want as a democracy? The other thing is vulture capitalism, and that's Romney. The complaint of the working class, as regards the breakdown of the manufacturing community and base in this country. People like Romney come in, pull out everything that's good, take the business and move it overseas, put people out of work, and reap the reward. And then you've got Wall Street socialism, which is what the 99% and the Tea Party have in common. That's about giving your taxpayer dollars to banks to bail them out, and they don't lend, and they pay it off in bonuses and sit on the rest and play that in the international market. Meanwhile, unemployment is rampant, and everybody keeps losing their houses. So, you know, there's nobody unifying that kind of economic analysis to say that all three of those are the argument that the 99% have against the 1%, and a change for the redistribution of government resources, and then the money we put in war. I mean, that basically protects the crony and the vulture capitalist. So it's all tied together.
How do you think the media has treated the whole issue of race in this Republican primary in South Carolina and the other states? We've seen the campaign where these same issues have been brought up. We had Juan Williams, of course, bring it up, and Newt Gingrich slammed him.
It was a setup. You know, it was a setup the same way that asking that question about marriage was a setup. And then, of course, that setup with Juan Williams, that was the Newt Gingrich's ad that was up the next morning and running all across the state. So it was a setup. But nobody really talks about race in a historical context. Everybody keeps talking about, well, that's old time. Or they just don't pick up a book and read and understand their history. They deal in the now instead of in context. We can't depend on the mainstream media to provide consciousness and do that kind of education, because their job is profit, too. They're not really concerned that Citizens United is overturned. They're making the money with all this money that's flown into politics.
That was writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Find a link to Kevin Gray's articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the backing of Hollywood movie studios, book publishers, and the music industry, the U.S. Senate's proposed Protect IP Act and House legislation dubbed the Stop Online Piracy Act looked like they were headed for easy passage. But the legislation designed to prevent the piracy of U.S. movies, music, and software confronted an effective grassroots campaign that viewed the legislation as a mortal threat to creativity, innovation, and freedom of expression on the Internet. Some of the largest internet companies like Google, Twitter, Reddit, and Facebook agreed and aided in the effort to defeat the piracy laws. Opponents maintain that the legislation is overbroad and would force search engine companies to act as censors on behalf of the holders of digital property rights, severely restricting freedom on the internet. Widespread online and street protests organized at the grassroots to oppose the piracy bills were launched on January 18th, and exceeded expectations when more than 115,000 websites participated by either going dark or featuring protest signs on their homepages. The protests generated an estimated 3 million emails and thousands of calls made to members of Congress expressing opposition to the bills. Not long after the protests began, many legislators who had previously supported the anti-piracy measures reversed course and announced opposition to the bills or support for a delay in scheduled votes. Your reporter spoke with Josh Levy, Internet Campaign Director with the media reform group Free Press, who talks about what's at stake for Internet freedom in the current fight over anti-piracy legislation.
These two bills, the Stop Online Piracy Act in the House and the Protect IP Act in the Senate, they're both basically the same versions of the bill, were designed in order to help deal with online piracy, the practice of sharing and copying copyrighted goods without permission. And while we think that the rights of content creators absolutely need to be respected, we and many, many others had a big issue with these bills because they went too far in trying to deal with this problem. And would have actually broken the Internet as we know it. And the open Internet, this Internet that we depend on to communicate with each other and that we expect to be able to access the content that we want and to communicate in the ways that we want and to say the things that we want. A lot of those things that we take for granted would have come under fire if these bills had gone through. So we stood up and we opposed them and we said, let's set aside the fact that we need to respect the right of content creators and take a look at what these bills actually accomplish. And what they would do is enable Internet service providers to erase URLs, the domain names of a site, so that it would not be able to be found on a site like Google, for example. It would be able to sever the relationship between these websites that are accused of piracy and other sites like PayPal, for example, or advertising networks, so that the income that would be coming into the accused sites would be cut off and they wouldn't be able to function anymore. Those and other provisions went so far that they would actually harm probably innocent sites, and they would create a chilling effect in which big corporations that hold copyright, like Disney, for example, could clamp down on any website that they accuse of infringing on that copyright, and people would feel less inclined to innovate, less inclined to create the new business models that we've known to occur on the open Internet, and all in the service of an old business model, which is grasping at straws and desperately trying to not enter the 21st century.
When you examine the effectiveness of the online and street protests that convinced many legislators on Capitol Hill to abandon these anti-piracy bills, maybe you could dissect a little bit about why these protests were so effective.
More than 10 million people sent letters to Congress in a day last Wednesday. And this was largely because of the efforts of folks like Wikipedia, which completely blacked out. So everybody who visited Wikipedia got a blacked out page that said Stop SOPA and TIPA, but also Google, which didn't black out, but it included a big bar across its logo. And when you clicked on that, you would get information about how to take action to stop these bills. And then in addition to them, thousands of other sites blacked out, included links to take action. Advocacy groups like Free Press and our friends sent out emails and had people either call Congress or take action by sending letters to Congress. You know, I had friends who would say, what effect does Wikipedia blacking out really have? You know, what would this do? And the answer was that it creates an enormous amount of attention for this work. And on that day, you could not escape media coverage of the fact that Wikipedia was blacking out and the fact it was blacking out for a reason. And naturally, people wanted to know more about those bills. So you take all that and then you look at Congress, which people need to understand is always deathly afraid of this kind of attention because it means that it needs to get off its butt and make a decision about something. And you had a lot of senators who hadn't necessarily taken a stand on the Protect IP Act who were forced to say something. And then you also had senators who had previously come out as supporters for that bill and realized that the tide had turned and the public was overwhelmingly against that bill and that it was in their own self-interest to change their position and to come out against that bill. So what you saw is kind of what takes place every day in Washington, except that it's usually lopsided in the other direction. You have senators who make decisions based on big corporations' interests because that's all they hear. Day in and day out, because of the lobbying power of those corporations, senators and members of the House are hearing why certain legislation needs to go through to improve the business interests of big oil or big media or other big concentrated interests, and they rarely hear the voices of regular people. So on this day, it was impossible to ignore the voices of ordinary people, and they realized that there was real opposition here, and it was okay, it was safe to come out against these bills. So I think it was incredibly heartening to realize that they actually listened.
That was Josh Levy, Internet Campaign Director with the media reform group Free Press. Learn more about the effect of piracy laws on Internet freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.